And today, our second speaker is Chris S. from the Spiritual Awakenings Group in Bernardsville. Chris is going to speak briefly about what he used to be like, and it's in-depth about what happened, steps 1 through 9, and what he's like now, steps 10, 11, 12, and I give you Chris.
Afternoon, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. On or around December 28th, 1989, I got separated from alcohol for the last time, and that was a good thing for me because that was a pretty spooky time, that last drunk. Things I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, things that you all have taught me, the fellowship and service have enabled me to maintain my spiritual condition to such a point that that God, as I understand Him, has kept me safe and protected from alcohol to this day, and that truly is a miracle. I want to thank Ava for speaking before. I always like hearing her talk. I always relate to a lot of the things that she talks about. I too was like a little alcoholic, you know, when I was younger. During an inventory, during one of the fear inventories that I was doing many years back, the person I was working with asked me to go back to the earliest recollection of any specific fear you're inventorying. And one of the fears that I was inventorying was fear of people. And I went back to the earliest recollection of fear of people that I could think of. And it was the day my mother was dropping me off for kindergarten. Hadn't gotten out a lot by myself up to this point. And, you know, this is kind of a new thing for me. And I remember she drove me uptown, parked along the side of this hill, and said, "There you go. There's the school right down there." And I get out of the car, and I remember standing up on this hill and looking down at all the kids. There's kids there. They're running around playing tag and kickball. It looked like they'd all been friends 100 years. And I'm standing up there on the hill looking down like an idiot. You know, I'm like, "Oh my God, I can't do this. What if they don't like me? You know, what if they make fun of me? What if I get beat up?" I mean, I'm thinking all this stuff. I was totally uncomfortable with the situation. And I got to tell you, at that point in time, I could have used a couple of shots of whiskey. And, you know, I just would have done much better with the whole kindergarten thing if I had a buzz on. I'd have been playing tag and kickball. I'd have been the kindergarten kid, you know what I mean? And I'd have probably done better at nap time than I did without the booze, too. But here's my problem. My problem was, they didn't give alcohol to five-year-olds. That's my problem. Because from that moment on, every second of the day in school, I had to pretend everything was okay inside me. Because I'm looking at you, and you're fine. You're okay, you know, at second period. You know what I mean? You're okay at recess. I'm like a bundle of self-centered fear. So I had to, from that day on, I had to act as if everything was okay. And until about, I think it was like 7th or 8th grade, I was about 12 or 13, I decided with a couple of my buddies that we were going to cut school and we were going to go back to my house and steal a bottle of booze from the liquor closet and get drunk. It's my first experience with alcohol. You know, we'd caused some trouble before that, and this just seemed like the next logical thing to do, to become a cool little 12-year-old. So we do this. We go back to my house, and we cut school, and I take the bottle down out of the shelf. Now, I don't know anything about drinking at this point in time. I come from a non-alcoholic household. I had to blow the dust off of this bottle. It'd probably been in there 10 years. But I don't know anything about drinking, but I remember the John Wayne movies. You remember those movies where he bust through the saloon doors, he'd go up to the bar, he'd go, "Bartender, whiskey!" And the bartender would take a bottle of whiskey and fill up like a water glass, and John would just like drink the whole water glass, grab the bottle, and go back to the table. So, you know, I don't know anything about drinking, so I take this Four Roses whiskey, which to this day, if I smell, you know what I mean? And I pour the three big water glasses for me and my two buddies. Now, my two buddies, who never became alcoholic, never became problem drinkers, you know, kept a 3.0 average, you know, in school. These guys, what they did was they drank about two-thirds of the glass of this stuff, and then they'd had enough. You ever drink with people who have enough? Isn't that like the most annoying thing? No thanks, no more for me. I'm going home to see the missus. I'm like, what? You know, drinking at the bar. What are you talking about? It's like 9 o'clock at night on a Monday. Let's go to the city, you know? I mean, come on, don't worry about work. That's what they have sick days for. So I never understood. So these two guys have had enough. You know what I did? I drank like 3 glasses of this stuff. I went into a blackout. I trashed the house, and I came to in a field, not knowing how I got there. That was my first experience with blackouts. Anybody in here ever have a blackout? There's some identification. Isn't that disconcerting? You know, blackout. You ever travel? You know, when you're in a blackout? You come to in Topeka with one shoe. You have to pretend you wanted to be there. You know? You don't want anybody to think you're stupid. You know, yeah, I always go to Topeka Thursdays looking for shoes. But, so I go into a blackout. I'm 12 years old. I'm already a blackout drinker. I could have qualified for AA, but I decided to drink for 20 more years. And it never really got much better. That day, Here's the problem, though, with that day. I had a nuclear hangover. I mean, I was so sick. You ever have those hangovers where you have to be flat for a couple of days? I mean, you don't be getting up. You're down. And I had one of those hangovers. I was out for 2 days from school, and I was just ill. Just ill. But if I would have put anything else in my body and it would have made me that ill, I would have stayed so far away from it. You know, if it was like a rutabaga or something that made me that sick, I got to tell you, I wouldn't need to go to a 12-step program to stay away from rutabagas. But here's what happened. Here's what happened. That alcohol changed my perception. It changed the way I felt about myself. That scared kindergartner, that alcohol was the anti-scared kindergartner potion. You know what I mean? All of a sudden I felt like, you get that feeling like, like everything is fine. I'm not self-centered anymore. You know, I'm not self-conscious. I'm everything, you know, I'm funny. There was dancing lessons in that bottle. You know what I mean? I didn't do anything. And then I went into a blackout and trashed the house. But I started to slowly forget about how terrible that hangover was, and I started to remember about, you know, how it made me feel. It made me feel larger than life. And I started to become preoccupied with alcohol from that moment on. I knew that Four Roses whiskey was out, you know, so I started the beer and the wine and the gin, you know, I mean, whatever. I would mix it up a little bit, and I always had problems allowing myself to be overserved. You know what I mean? That usually plagued me. It was always like, I had like one too many, you know, and crashed the car or whatever. That was that last drink. But I began the task of managing my alcohol consumption because that's what I had to do. I had to manage my thinking about living life without alcohol at this time wasn't even something to be considered. You know, I used to see the Nancy Reagan commercials. Just say no. Say no. What are you talking about? Say no to high prices, maybe, but you know, say no. Come on, and that wasn't something that would compute. And so, you ever talk to like a newcomer? You know, like, well, your life is completely in the toilet. You know, you're drinking yourself to death. And you've alienated everybody. I'd like you to start going to meetings every night. And they look at you like, what? You know, they think it's like an overreaction to like a problem that's not quite that big. Well, you know, that's the way I kind of felt. Anyway, I'm moving along, and alcohol is to a point working for me in the early days. I'm in high school now, and I can't wait for the Friday and Saturday parties. You know, you just have a blast at the parties. And alcohol's working, and you're paying a little bit of a price to drink. You're crashing a car here or there, you know, getting into a fight, or you know, like hitting on the wrong girl. You know, I mean, you get past all that stuff. You know, somebody would die every once in a while. You just kind of got to move on, you know. And you just move through the stuff and manage it because alcohol is working. Here's the problem. I come from a really smart family. My brother and sister are both Phi Beta Kappa, PhDs. My mother and father were master's degree educators, college professors, a really smart family. I graduated the second stupidest person in the high school. I didn't apply myself. Anybody ever tell you you've got a lot of potential? I was the potential kid. And until they stop telling you because they think they might have misunderstood your case. But anyway, here's what happened. I mean, alcohol had me so preoccupied, and I also come from the late 60s and early 70s, so there were some non-conference approved substances out there besides alcohol that I would partake in, you know what I mean? And you'd have a couple of pills in your hand. I go, "Coo-coo." I just did. And I go, "What was that?" You know what I mean? Could have been a birth control pill, or something. A dog worming pill. I'd ask you afterward. So, I mean, just get me out of me. So I didn't really apply myself at school. And, my whole future is really being affected by the way I'm acting. But what do you say? Who cares is what you say. I mean, I never said, alcohol and drugs are really affecting my performance in my academics here. If I keep on like this, I may not get into the college of my choice. I mean, I never said that. The guy took Wednesdays off every day just to break up the week. The teacher would go, "Where's Chris?" "Oh, yeah, that's right, it's Wednesday. It's his day off." I didn't care. Well, anyway, it gets to the point where I'm done with high school, and people grow up that aren't major alcoholic. They go off to college or they get a job. Some of them are even getting married and putting a little house together with the picket fence. I'm still looking for that high school party because I'm still 100% into let's have a really good time. And so slowly, the people that I was hanging out with are disappearing, and I'm having to go for lower and lower common denominator partiers. You know what I'm saying? After a while, the people I was drinking with didn't even have real names. They were like Weezer and Green Man. And there was a guy named Rat, going over to Rat's house to party. They all had their own parole officer. And I'm okay with all this. I'm okay with those. Now, every single day, alcohol is taking more and more of a toll on me. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. I come from a time where friends let friends drive drunk. You know what I mean? It's like, the drunkest guy gets the keys because it's more exciting. You know what I mean? And that's just, so I never even thought about it. I'd crash one more car and I'd say to myself, "I've got to stop driving." I never said I've got to stop drinking. I married up with somebody. I met this wonderful codependent woman. She was from an alcoholic family, so my dysfunction looked like home. You know what I mean? And she hooked up with me, and it was a perfect relationship because she thought about me almost as much as I did. You know what I mean? And it worked that way. And, she was really good about bailing me out and going to the impound place to get the car back and, all that stuff. She knew how to put my head over the edge of the couch so I don't drown in my own vomit. And she knew all the stuff that you need to know. And it worked out for a while, but even she couldn't put up with it after a while. She was Catholic, so 9 months to the nanosecond after we got married, my daughter was born. And so here I am, I'm like husband and father. I'm like 23 years old, drinking every night. There's not a chance in hell I could be responsible at this point in time in my life. I couldn't give this family anything that they needed. You know what I mean? They wanted things that I thought were really unreasonable, like get a job, put insurance on a car, stop hanging out with Rat and Green Man, and come home at night, and get off my back. Just get off my back, will you? I can't take this pressure. She was going to work, and I was sitting at home watching Love Boat reruns, smoking joints, like, you know, watching Gopher fall in love again. I mean, I couldn't get out of the house. So it wasn't working. She split, and I moved into a household of insane guys. I mean, and guess what? Now I could really drink. You want to know why? Because she left me when I needed her most. You know what I mean? She left me when I needed her most. So I am drinking bottles of whiskey every single night just with the two most insane people in Tampa, Florida. You know, one guy was a Quaalude salesman, and the other guy had been on unemployment for 4 years. I didn't even know you could do that, you know? So here we are, we're in this house, and I mean, it really got ugly. And, my wife had left. She'd gone back to New Jersey, and I was getting in trouble with the cops. There was summonses, outstanding warrants. I hadn't shown up for court. I was supposed to do community service. There's bills from ambulances because I was always going to the hospital for some crazy thing. Life was kind of piling up on me. It was getting unmanageable, you know what I mean? What do you do when life gets unmanageable like that? Start thinking if mom needs any help at home. You know what I mean? She's back there in New Jersey all by herself. I'm going to give her a call, you know. Say, hey, mom, I'm coming back up. You need some help, Rana. So I go back up and I live with my mother for 8 years of the worst of my drink. I burnt the house down twice, you know what I mean? So anyway... I'm back up in New Jersey, and now even Green Man and Weezer are gone. I'm sitting in a room in my mother's house, and I've got a relationship with the bottle. I would buy like a bottle of George Dickel, and I would like look at it, you know, and I'd caress it, and I'd pour it out, and I'd get drunk out of my mind. It was a very unrequited love affair, let me tell you, because what that alcohol was doing to me at that point in time, I mean. The alcoholic is so insane. You know, they talk about denial a lot of times in the rooms, but that's not really what we have. Denial is knowing the truth in the back of your mind, but saying, no, that's not the truth. Well, we're delusional. We don't even know that we can't see the truth. You know, we're so sick, we don't even think we're sick. And that's the way it was for me at this point in time. Here I am. I'm too drunk and lazy to get up and walk through the room, out into the hall to go to the bathroom. So when I have to puke, I throw open the window and I stick my head out and I puke out the window. And there's a sidewalk right there and there's like an old folks home near my house. And, you know, and I'm puking out the window and I'm thinking to myself, where are all the babes? You know what I mean? I haven't had a relationship in like 3 years. What's the matter here? You know? I mean, I'm like this pathetic drunk. Really. I'm the type of drunk you just don't want me in your house. One of the last things I did was this one guy was trying to help me, so they'd invite me out to Pennsylvania for the weekend and they'd try to monitor my drinking and, you know, give me positive affirmations and all this. I remember this one time, now you're not going to drink, are you? Because I promise. Well, I found their closet, and behind the post toasties or whatever was some bottles of booze. And I'd go in there when they weren't looking and I got trashed. And they're wondering, like, we just gave him two beers. How's he that trashed? And I remember I'm lying, and they put brand new carpet in. They're so proud of this house. And I'm sitting back like this. And I don't know this because I'm in a blackout, but what I do is I cough up this nasty lunger and just spit right on their carpet. And here's, I come out of the blackout and they're down on their hands and knees with brushes. Like this is the type of person who you invite over, you know, I mean, you know, so my sphere of community is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It's just so pathetic. I become an electrician somehow, okay? I don't know how that happened, but can you imagine, like, a worse trade? Every day, I'd electrocute myself. I mean, my hair was always sticking straight up. They called me Ignatowski. It worked. Oh, boss, I blew up the lady's garage again. You know? And, I mean, I do stupid things. I'll tell you a couple. One of the ones was I accidentally drilled in the wrong place, and I drilled down into this guy's closet. And I have to go down there, and he opens up the doors, and there's like 13 suits all covered with plaster. One of them's curled up into the ceiling where my drill bit caught it, you know? Another time, I wired a whole kitchen addition to the wrong panel. And it was a timer panel for the hot water heater. So the kitchen would come on at 8 o'clock at night and go off at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, so they call my boss up and they say, hey, we eat at 6. This is unacceptable. You know? But probably the most embarrassing thing, I'm an electrician at Epstein's. Epstein's was something like Macy's or something. And the job I have to do is I have to drill down by all the cash register places for the new computer lines that we're going in. And I'm doing this down in the lingerie section of Epstein's. And I'm kind of preoccupied, if you know what I mean. I'm like looking around because it's pretty interesting. And I have this big, giant steel drill that has a locking trigger, big half-inch drill, and it gets away from me. Okay, so I bear down on it, and it starts twisting me around circles like this, and it ties me up in the cord. And the auger bit rips the pants right off my ass. And finally it unplugs from the wall, and I'm hanging with my pants off, tied up to the drill, in the middle of the lingerie section of Epstein's. I mean, and you gotta act like you're cool about it, you know? This drill does this all the time, you know? I told him to get me another one. I mean, so... It's really bad. It's really bad. And here's the straw that broke the camel's back, okay? I mean, I've lost my family, 9 totals, 3 DWIs, no friends. I mean, you know, everything has fallen away. But here's the straw that broke the camel's back. I'm trying to put a ground screw in a ceiling fixture box, and I'm shaking so bad from the night before, you know, the DTs, and the screw keeps falling off the end of the screwdriver. And I'm 33 years old, and my boss has a 19-year-old kid who's in charge of me. I mean, that's how much respect I had at work. Junior was the boss. So anyway, he's looking at me, watching me drop this screw. And have you ever hear somebody think at you as an alcoholic? You can, if you listen hard enough. He's looking at me like this, and he's thinking, you pathetic, you good for nothing, no account, loser. And I just couldn't take it. I couldn't take it. So that night, I got really drunk, and I called up the rehab, and I said, I'm coming in. You know, I'm checking myself in. I've got to do something about this drinking. And I go into the rehab, and I spent 28 days in there. I'd like to say something positive about this particular rehab, but what I will say is I did get the $13,000 big book and the pat on the butt to AA. That's about all I remember from it, except for doing group. You ever do group where they're sitting around a circle and he's talking about his issues and then he's talking about his issues. Shut up, will you? I want to talk about my issues. You're spending way too much time on your issues. I should just drink. You know, and I remember that from group, you know, and that's about it. So I get out and I go to AA. I go to AA, and now I really want to stay separated from alcohol. I've got to tell you, there was not one person in that AA meeting that wanted to separate from alcohol more than me. I signed myself into rehab. I'm paying for outpatient to go to group and hear people talk about their issues. I'm going to AA meetings. It's like the castor oil type of going to AA meetings. Like you go there to take your medicine. You know what I mean? And I'm doing all this so that I stay sober. And I'm almost 90 days sober, and on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crosses my mind that, man, it's been almost 3 months since I've been drunk. I don't even remember what it's like to be drunk. I haven't drank in so long. And you know, this AA stuff, it probably works better if you remember more about being drunk. So I know what I'll do. I'll get a gallon of vodka, I'll go home, I'll drink it, and it'll improve my sobriety. Okay, I now know what the first step is talking about when it says we have an obsession of the mind. Alcohol doesn't care if I don't want to drink it. You know what I mean? It'll convince me that it's a good idea to drink it so that I won't drink it. I mean, it's nuts. So I do. I start drinking. I'm about three drinks into this gallon of vodka, and I realize the enormity of my mistake. I'm like, oh my God. I've like opened up the cage door to the beast. He's going to drag me around. Who knows where this is going to end? Oh my God, I can't believe I've done this. Now think about it. Was I insane before I picked up the drink or after? The insanity that they talk about in the second step, I experienced it 3 months sober. It was the thought that I could put alcohol back in my body. Now, 5 months later, I mean, the worst 5 months of my drinking ever, it culminates in Christmas at the Schroeder's. Okay? This is December 1989. My mother's there, my brother, sister, nieces and nephews, there's cats. I mean, the tree is up and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care. And I start drinking, right? And I'm resentful. I've got a resentment about something. I'm going to kill all you. And I threaten everybody's life over, it's Christmas, you know? And it's not really the festive type of atmosphere they would have liked, so they all leave. And they go and they have Christmas in upstate New York. Thank you. Now, I come out of like a three-day blackout. And I used to buy one bottle at a time because I might quit tomorrow. You ever do that? It's like the person that buys one pack of cigarettes. They've been smoking for 30 years. So anyway, there's a pile of vodka bottles in the sink like this that I don't even remember buying. I can imagine like staggering uptown 40 times buying bottles of vodka. I must have been a sight. But I come out of this three-day blackout and I start to go into the DTs. I mean, the flat-out DT. Anybody in here ever have the DTs knows exactly what I mean. All you feel is terror. You know? I start to hallucinate. I'm seeing animals running around. There's things scratching on the house trying to get in. There's maggots all over the slip covers. You know, it's disconcerting. And I remember I'm lying down on the couch, and a demon comes out of the ceiling. This big bull-headed demon to eat my face. I'm like, yeah! And that's the point where I scream out to God. I go, God, please, either kill me or let me get sober. I can't live like this. And that I haven't had a drink from that point in time, I swear to God. I know I've got to go back to AA. I know I don't need another $13,000 big book. I know I need to go to AA. So as soon as I'm detoxed enough to go to AA, I figure out where I'm going to go. Now, I've got a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls, with the clutches almost gone, no emergency brake, no heater core, so when you turn the heater on, it squirts antifreeze on the inside of the window. It's got no muffler. Alright, it's got orange paint all over the interior from I don't know where, and I've got to drive to a meeting, but it's going to have to be a flat meeting because I've got no clutch. Okay, so I look into the book, and I find a flat meeting, and that's in Morristown. So I get there, and it's a church kind of like this, and on the outside there's 500 of my new peers out on the porch smoking cigarettes, right, as I pull up. And I've got to go up a little incline to get into the parking lot. That's a problem, right? I mean, I've got no clutch, so I have to gun this thing. And it's got no muffler. It sounds like an insane motorboat. And I go, like half a mile an hour past all these people. They're all like, must be a new guy, you know? And I pull in and I'm shattered. I'm like, you know, I walk into the meeting and I sit down and somebody hands me a step book. I'm like, what? You know, they hand me a step book. And I realize that I'm sitting in a step meeting and they're reading paragraphs out of the book and they're moving and they're coming down the row at me. I'm going to have to read a paragraph. And I panic, right? I got to get out of here. So I leave now, and I'm still, you know, I got to tell you, I'm standing out on the porch, and I'm smoking a cigarette, and I'm thinking, can I do this? This is crazy. I don't know if I can do this. You know, and I'm thinking, it's either I do this, which I'm just terrified to do, or I go drink, which I'm terrified to do, and I don't know what to do. And this guy, I'll never forget, his name was Jorge. He saw me leave, and he came out to talk to me. Now, this guy, I found out years later, he had 16 days or something. He pulled a 12-step number on me like I'll never forget. Anyway, he comes out and he starts talking to me. He starts going, well, what's your deal? And I'm like, oh, there's a relapse of the terrible demons that killed everybody. It's horrible. And he goes, well, come on back into the meeting. Come on back into the meeting. And I'm like, well, tomorrow there's a meeting in Baskin Ridge. You know, tomorrow. He's like, no, come on back in the meeting. He had 16 days, but he knew what tomorrow meant for an alcoholic. So, you know, he drags me back inside and sits me down in the second row. Now, by this time, people are sharing. And he leans over to me and he goes, raise your hand, tell everybody you're coming back. I'm like, well, tomorrow there's a meeting where you go around a room and it's everybody's coming back. And he's like, raise your hand. He's starting to get loud now. And, you know, people are starting to look. And you know what happens after they start looking? They'll start thinking at you. You know, so I got to do something. And so there's somebody sharing. And right in the middle of somebody sharing, I put my hand up. And the person leading the meeting is like looking at me and shuts the person up who's talking and calls on me. And I say something like this. And go, screws on alcoholism, and drinking whiskey. I was just terribly gosh, to thank you. And there's a quiet. And then all of a sudden, yay! And everybody starts to applaud. They're like, you know, I could just figure, you know, you, the most pathetic person I've heard in weeks. I came in tonight thinking I had problems. Oh, thank you so much. And because I was so bad. And at that moment in time, I've got to tell you, at that moment in time, something dropped off of my shoulders that I was carrying. I don't know what it was, but I started to think, maybe I can make it. Maybe I can do this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. Shit, I told everybody I was coming back. That's like one of the hardest things you can do. And I started to have a little bit of hope. And I started to go to meetings. The next night, I got myself a sponsor, Fish Food Phil. Got him as a sponsor. Everybody had nicknames back then. Radio Shack, Mike, Bummed Out Bob. Doing an inventory one time, and I realized they've got nicknames because I'm nicknaming them, you know? Poor bastards. This guy hasn't worked in Radio Shack in 16 years. Everybody still calls him Radio Shack Mike. So anyway, I get Fish Food Phil as a sponsor, and I remember going to him and I said, look, Phil, I've been in hell. Tell me how to get out. I'll do anything. And he starts working on my fellowship commitments, okay? This is back in late 89, early 1990, and there was not a hell of a lot of big book sponsorship or stuff back then. They got you involved in the fellowship, and you were given fellowship commitments and things. And he said, Chris, I want you to go to a meeting every night. I'm not going to tell you to do 90 meetings in 90 days because it's not a 90-day program. You do a meeting every night until I tell you to stop. And he said, you know, I want to see you here, I want to see you here, I want to see you here. So I started doing the meetings. And I started getting active, and I started to feel a little bit better, because there's no more booze in my system. You know, I'm starting to feel a little more healthy. Now, I became a secretary at this group. I got a chance to lead the beginners meeting over here. I even people were asking me to sponsor them because, you know, I have no idea why. I guess it's sometimes a tugboat with the most steam, you know, gets to pull the boats or something. And you know, I sounded good. You know, if they'd have seen me at home, like yelling at my mother because there's no ice cubes in the ice cube tray. Well, there's no ice in the ice cube tray. Don't you know I need ice? You know? I mean, if they'd have seen that, they might not have asked me to sponsor. But I, you know, I gave good share in the meetings, you know. But there was something still really, really wrong. You know that scared kindergartner, that person who just doesn't feel comfortable with themselves or their environment? I just, you know, everything was like a struggle, and I had to act as if everything was okay all the time. Well, that's still all over me, and I'm sober about a year now. You know, I'm sober, and I'm thinking to myself, man, I should be feeling better, but, you know, I'm still like tortured by myself. And my friend Radio Shack Mike, He had given me some tapes to listen to at this one point. He gave me some Louise Hay tapes, affirmation tapes. Anybody ever listen to that? I'm like a shattered alcoholic, and I put this tape in, and you're supposed to repeat after yourself, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Like 50 times until you believe it. Like, in front of the mirror, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. The hell is this? You know, take that tape and throw it at him. You know, what are you doing? I mean, seriously, trying to treat alcoholism with an affirmation tape is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? It's not happening. So he comes up to me and he goes, Chris, I've got these tapes. They're really hardcore. You'd like them. And I don't really trust his choice in tapes at this point in time, but I've got a long ride to work. So I take them and I pop them in. And they're from a couple of guys are doing a big book study from Arkansas. Like, Arkansas? I hate people from Arkansas. I'm from the Northeast. We do more thinking by 9 o'clock in the morning than an Arkansasian's going to do all day. What the hell is somebody from Arkansas going to teach me? You know? But I've got a long ride to work, so I plug this thing in. If I had a faster speed, I would have put it on that. Because these guys talk like this. I'm like, hurry up, hurry up. But anyway, I'm listening to it, and I get all the way through this series, and you know, I've got a resentment now, really, against Arkansas, because here's what they told me. They said, Chris, you're in the fellowship. You're not in the program. You have no program. You're not working any of the instructions out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, so don't say you have a program. And you know what? If you relapse, don't tell anybody AA didn't work, because you didn't work AA, because the AA program is in the big book. You loser. And this is what these tapes said, okay? Like, God damn it, I knew I hated people from Arkansas for a reason. But I'll tell you what, if you're an alcoholic, the truth will haunt you. The truth will haunt you. There's a section in the big book that says if we've disturbed you about your alcoholism, this is all to the good. Because you're going to have to come to terms with that disturbance, whatever it is. And usually what will happen is you'll recognize some of the truth in it that's making you mad. And the truth was, I need to work harder than I've been working. Yeah, I'm making coffee till the grinds come out my ears. I'm doing all that stuff. But I'm not working a recovery program. So I threw the tapes to the side, and you know, I burned it in resentment for it. But after a while, you know, that internal condition, that untreated alcoholism, just was getting me, and I said, God damn it. And I took these tapes out again, and I bought a big book because I lost mine. You know how it is with big books. I opened it up, and I started listening to tapes, and I started to do a program. And, you know, I don't recommend that, like, if you're new, to just do the program by yourself, because it was pretty bastardized, you know, Chris when he's very, very mentally ill type of a program. But it was enough of a program for me to start, for my spirit to start to heal, for that scared kindergartner to start to mature into an adult. And the course of time, but I had a lot of sponsees at this time who were drinking on me. You ever have a sponsee drink on you? Makes you look bad, you know what I mean? Somebody comes up to you and says, hey, is Harry yours? Do you know he's drinking and he's borrowing money? And you know, it makes you look bad. So I've got to do something about this, all these sponsees drinking. So I get some, I start to bring them over to my house, and I start to go through the big book, the Joe and Charlie way from Arkansas. And we're sitting out of my house, and you know, we're working through the steps. And T was one of the early victims of this, you know, damn near killed him doing it. But along the way, I started to understand a little bit about the recovery process, and and the people who hung in there, the people who did the steps, did the fourth and the fifth step, did the amends, they're all still around. They're all still around in AA, and they're all working with other people. And so I started to realize that there was three parts to AA. There's the meetings, that's the fellowship. There's the service commitments, that's everything you can do to keep the message being carried or carry the message. And then there's the recovery process, which is that healing, that internal condition that we all have, that makes us uncomfortable with ourselves and uncomfortable with our environment and uncomfortable with crowds and uncomfortable with police and uncomfortable with families at Christmas and all that stuff. It starts to heal that stuff. So anyway, along the line, a group of us are now in recovery. We're in the fellowship of the Spirit instead of in the spirit of the fellowship. And I've got a meeting going on at my house on Thursday night. And people are coming over to go through the steps. And it started off by being the people I'm sponsoring. Okay? But then they would say, hey, can I bring over my buddy here? And all of a sudden this meeting started up in my room. Now, I took somebody through the steps whose sponsor came to me and said, hey, I'm really seeing the change in so-and-so over here. How about taking me through the steps? This guy had like 10 years at the time. So I go, okay, so I take him through the steps. He's working with a priest who sees the change in him and says, what the hell happened to you? And the guy goes, well, I'm going through the steps with this Chris guy. He goes, where can I find him? And he goes, well, he's speaking up in Mekong or whatever. And this priest comes up to me after giving a pitch in Mekong and says, hi, I'm friends with so-and-so over here. Whatever you're doing up in your room, I want you to do it in my church. Because I don't any night you want, don't want any money. I want this to be part of our church's mission. And I'm like, how am I going to do this? Because I got to tell you, at this period of time, there was step meetings, there was speaker meetings, and there was discussion meetings. There was not Chris teach the big book meetings. You know what I mean? And the amount of flack I'm going to get for this is going to be just way too much for me to really want to deal with. But I recognize the fact that this is a providential act. It's not incumbent upon me to say no to this. So we start a little group on Tuesday night in Bernardsville. And it grows from 15, 20 people to there's depending on who's there presenting, there's sometimes 100 people there on Tuesday night. And that group has influenced a lot of other groups around because it really was the first educational type of meeting where somebody is interested in actually presenting the recovery process and the actual mechanics of the recovery process from their own experience. So that happens. It's good. Now, some of my work life. I went from being an electrician to working at a college in a facilities department. I went from there to becoming a buildings and grounds manager. Today I work for a company as a general manager, and I have 60 employees that report to me. I've got a budget of a couple of million dollars that is, I have complete ability to use it as I see fit. I got to tell you, back when I was drinking or an early sobriety, you wouldn't have put me in charge of a lemonade stand. You know what I mean? You would have worried about the lemon overhead disappearing or something. I mean, I swear to God, and it's a hell of a lot of responsibility, and there's human resource issues, and there's all this kind of stuff. And I've found that I'm actually a pretty good manager. I'm a pretty decent manager, and. I actually, out of 3,000 employees in the country, I won the Financial Performance Award for 2005 in my company. Can you imagine? I had a comic book collection when I got sober. That was the thing that was the most valuable possession. Was my Spider-Man issues from the 60s. I mean, financial performance. Oh my God. So, a lot of friendships. I have today just so many friends. It's unbelievable. I remember when I was first sober, or I even remember back when I was drinking, and even before that, I would seek out and really work toward making friends with people, and that's really not what it's about today. I've found that by working a decent program. And being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and being of service in my job and in my community, my problem is too many friends. The phone is ringing too much, and there's too many things, too many options out there for me to participate in. I'm unbelievably grateful for that. I drive a car that's manufactured during my current period of sobriety. Now, if you're new or just coming back, that's something to shoot for. Because, I always was the last owner of every car I ever had. I sold a car in sobriety. I was like, how did you do that? What's the title? They always went to the junkyard. You know, my relationships, I had horrible relationships when I was drinking. You know, I went from the Catholic codependent all the way down to a Hell's Angel Harley old lady before I got sober. And that's fine, but like I lived in Basking Ridge and I brought her home to live with Mom. You know, I got to tell you, that didn't work. That didn't work. She always wanted to be armed and, you know, the parole officers and I met her through this prison pen pal thing. Somebody told me to. I go, if you're new or just coming back, we don't recommend that as a dating method. Okay? Did not work for me. Today I'm married to an absolutely wonderful woman. She works with as many women as I work with guys, and we've got like a recovery house. You know what I mean? Like somebody will be doing a fifth step in this room, or you know, what are you doing? So and so's coming over. We've got to work on the step. I mean, it's there's people detoxing in our house every once in a while. You know, which you try to avoid too. If you have to do it, those extra thick Glad bags are nice to have around. You know, keeps the carpets clean. I've got to tell you, there's so many good things going on in my life. Somewhere along the line, because of the big book work and the Burnsville meeting, I started getting asked to do workshops here and there. And that's been a real blessing in my life. I absolutely love doing that. Next weekend, I'm going to be up at the Wilson House, Bill Wilson's birthplace in Dorset, Vermont, doing a workshop with Peter M., who spoke here, I think, what was it, last night? Yeah. Peter and I are going to be doing a workshop up there, which should be different. It should be fun. We'll see how that works. You know, I've been able to meet so many different people around the Northeast. I've been influential in starting meetings in Minneapolis and Sarasota, Florida, and all over the place, Charlotte, Virginia. It's just been, I've been so overpaid. You got to understand, I was like a pathetic alcoholic that nobody wanted anything to do with because I brought absolutely no value at all to anything. So it was like I was like the type of person you just wanted them to stay away. I'd get a new job and they'd make the mistake of saying, "Hey, Chris, you want to go out for a couple of drinks? It's Friday." The next Monday, they'd be, "Stay away from it. Just stay away. I can't believe you started that fight, you know, with those truck drivers. Are you crazy? You know, and yes, I'm crazy, you know. You shouldn't have asked me to go out, you know. It's your fault." So that's what I was like. And, you know, today I'm just so overpaid in every area of my life. I'll bet you there's people in this room that love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I do. But I'll tell you what, there's nobody who loves it more than I do. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new or just coming back and you're having trouble with personal relationships, you can't seem to get along with your family, you know, the boss is always out to get you. You know, there's vindictive police officers, and your family doesn't understand you, and it just, you know, like bad breaks and misunderstandings everywhere, and you know, yeah, alcohol's probably involved a little bit, but you know, I've got deeper problems. You don't understand. I'm different. If you feel that way, welcome to AA. That's the requirement for membership. Thanks for letting me speak.